England, There England by A.G. MacDonald. Adapted in 6 parts by Bob Sinfield and narrated by Leslie Phillips. Episode 4.
A few days after his curious experience on the cricket field, our young Scottish hero, Donald Cameron, found his attention being drawn away from the English national game by a newspaper article on the subject of golf.
England's recent defeat at the hands of the stern and wild Caledonians was demnition horrid, and the only consolation lies in the fact that the victors consisted almost entirely of what are called Anglo-Scots, domiciled in England and products of English golf, for there is no doubt that the balance of golfing power has shifted to the south. England is now the real custodian of the ancient traditions of the game.
Donald read through this very carefully, but it seemed to be a matter of importance to him, and his task of writing a book about quintessential English behaviour. Having seen the English engaged in their own indigenous pastime of cricket, he had been unable to make head nor tail of it, but it was worth finding out how they treated another country's national game, which, according to the newspaper, they had not only mastered but adopted. The matter was easily arranged, for he had already been invited to a day's golf by Sir Ludovic Phibbs, MP. On the following Sunday, he was picked up on the corner of Royal Avenue and King's Road, Chelsea, by Sir Ludovic's Rolls-Royce limousine.
It's a scandal, you know.
It is?
The dole. Everyone who takes the dole ought to be shot. Don't teach them not to slack. Abolish trade unions. Harder work all round. That'll solve everything.
I see.
Yeah, make them work Saturday afternoons and Sundays. Half day Sunday. I'm not a tyrant.
Mm. Of course, I'm no expert, but it strikes me a lot of people don't have jobs in the first place.
My point exactly. Slackers. The lot of them.
This theme lasted most of the journey to Cedar Park, one of the newest of the great golf clubs in the southeast. The moment he entered the clubhouse, a superb spectacle met Donald's gaze. Superb enough to take his mind off the loud squeak of his nail-studded shoes on the parquet floor. It was a group of golfers standing in front of the huge fireplace. There were purple jumpers and green jumpers and yellow jumpers and tartan jumpers. There were the biggest, the baggiest, the brightest plus four that ever dulled the luster of a peacock's tail. Donald felt like a navvy, painfully conscious of his sagging grey flannels and the hole in the elbow of his 1914 golfing coat, but not sufficiently conscious of his clubs to avoid dropping them.
Clubs go in the locker room, sir.
Oh, sorry, thank you. That's very kind.
The locker room was full of young gentlemen discarding their jumpers in favour of brown leather jerkins fastened up the front with that singular arrangement, the zipper. Donald edged in furtively, hazily watched the flunky Lay's clubs on a bench, then fled in panic through the nearest open door and found himself in a wire-netted enclosure packed with the dense throng of caddies.
Hello.
He backed awkwardly out of the enclosure until being brought up sharp by the wall of the professional shop. The caddies, and worse still, an exquisitely beautiful young lady who'd just emerged from the shop, watched him with interest. Scarlet in the face, he rushed past the radiant beauty and hid himself in the shop's darkest corner, pretending to be utterly absorbed in a driver he'd picked out at random from the rack.
Are they 52 shilling and cheap at bar?
How much? £2.12 for a driver?
Aye, that's what I... Just a minute. Why, it's Maister Donald. You mind me, Maister Donald? Jim Glennie, assistant that was at Glenavy to Tommy Anderson that went to the States.
Glennie, of course.
Man, but I'm glad to see you.
Glennie, where did you learn that bucking accent?
Never used to talk like that.
Shh, I've picked it up since coming south. Huh? They like the Scotsman Scottish. It makes the profit something extraordinary.
Ah, Glennie, you old swindler. Now, how much do you want to sting me for this putter?
32 shilling and sixpence, Sir Walter. But you'll be wasting your cellar, for neither that club nor any other will bring you down below 18.
Is that so? We'll see.
You see, Master Donald, he'll buy it and tell his friends I try to dissuade him, and they'd all agree that I'm a rare old character, and they'll all come and buy too.
But Glennie, 52 shillings for a driver? Do you mean to say they'll pay that?
Of course. They'll pay anything so long as it's more than the other clubs charge them. That's the whole secret. Those drivers there aren't a new set at all. Last weekend they were on for 48 shillings. But I heard in the week that young Jock Robbie over at Addingdale had put his drivers up from 46 to 50. Dirty young dog. Not that I blame him. It's a new form of commercial competition, Master Donald. A sort of inverted price cutting.
Mm-hmm. Very smart.
Did you say you wanted a driver?
Oh, not at 52 shillings.
Of course not. You shall have your pick of the shop at cost price. 15 and 6.
That's better. 15 and...
Shh! There you are, Cameron. Just two couples in front of us now. Are you ready?
Yes, sir. I was just...
Morning, Glennie, you old shark. No use trying to swing the lead over Mr. Cameron. He's an Aberdonian himself.
Oh, is that a fact, Sir Ludovic? I'd noticed near trace of an accent.
Come along, then.
Driver, Mr. Donald.
Thanks, but are you sure?
Of course. And here, take a box of balls.
For auld lang syne.
On the first tee, Sir Ludovic introduced Donald to the other two players who were going to make up the match.
Cameron, I'd like you to meet Mr. Woolston and Mr. Giles.
Pleased to meet you.
How do you do?
Fine, oh, yes. How do you do?
Both these gentlemen are in the city.
Which city is that?
Stocks and shares.
I suggest we play a four-ball foursome. Woolston and I against you two on handicap, taking our strokes from the course. 5 bob corners, half a crown for each birdie, $1 an eagle, a bob best ball and a bob aggregate and a bob putt. Agreed?
Yeah, agreed.
Cameron?
Oh, yes.
The truth was that Donald hadn't understood a single word except the phrase four-ball foursome, and that was incorrect. The stakes sounded enormous to him, but he could scarcely object. When it was his turn to drive at the first tee, he selected a spot and tapped it with the toe of his driver. Nothing happened. He looked at his elderly caddy and tapped the ground again. Again, nothing happened.
Want a peg, Cameron?
Oh, no, I never drink this early.
The elderly caddy lurched forward with the loathsome little contrivance of blue and white celluloid. Donald shuddered. Next, they'd be giving him a rubber tee with a tassel. He teed his ball on a pinch of sand with a dexterous twist of his fingers and thumb amid an incredulous silence. After a few holes of uncertainty, much of his old skill came back, but he had a little difficulty with his elderly caddy.
Can you hand me the iron, please?
Which number, sir?
Which number what?
Which number iron?
Just the iron.
It must have a number, sir.
Why must it?
Well, all irons have numbers.
But I've only got one.
Only a number one?
No, only one.
Only one what, sir?
One iron.
Oh. Mr. Fumbledon has 11 now.
11 what?
11 irons.
Apart from this revelation of Mr. Fumbledon's greatness, Donald didn't learn an enormous amount during the game. He never knew what the state of the match was, till they were all ranged in front of the clubroom bar.
Here you are, Cameron. £1.16 and 6. Not bad, eh?
No, probably not.
Same again all round, then. Hollis, 4 more doubles, we'll take them through to lunch. Then when we're all sat down, I'll tell you my plan for getting this country back on its feet. We start by shooting all those slackers on the dole.
Lunch was an impressive affair. Sir Ludovic insisted on being host and ordered Donald's half pint of beer and double whiskies for himself and his friends. The five-course meal was topped off with four of the biggest glasses of hunting port Donald had ever seen. Finally, they sallied out to play a second round, but the golf was at best indifferent.
Oh, bad luck. No good. I can't focus properly. Must be the old trouble.
The others were no better. By common consent, the afternoon round was abandoned after eight holes. Donald was handed 17 shillings as his inexplicable winnings, and after a rubber bridge and even more refreshment, Sir Ludovic offered Donald a lift home. Luckily, the chauffeur was driving.
Now, Kevin, did I tell you about my plan to shoot these slackers on the dole?
The next day, Donald received a call from his friend and fellow war veteran, Davies, the man responsible for this insane book idea in the first place. He wanted the would-be author to drop in at his publishing house and give a progress report.
Progress? Davies, I am out of my depth. Well, I didn't think you'd find it very easy. But remember what I told you in that bloody pillbox 10 years ago? I've got this instinctive notion that the English character...
There's no such thing. They're all different.
That the English character is based fundamentally on kindness and poetry. Just keep that in mind. It doesn't matter if you agree or not. Now, I've got a job for you.
What sort of job?
Oh, it's nothing much. It's just a private secretaryship.
What?
But what about my work for the London Weekly and this book I'm meant to be writing? Donkey brain, I am trying to help you. It's only temporary, and it means working for an English politician. English, is he? Hmm? He's an old friend of mine. His regular chap's gone down with scarlet fever.
The Parliament isn't even sitting just now.
Ah, you see, you're an expert on politics already. Though the point is, my friend's off to Geneva in a fortnight for the Assembly of the League of Nations. He wants you to go with him, hold his hat and coat.
How long for?
Oh, it's only a month. All expenses and a fiver a week. He should give you a good notion of the Englishman as an internationalist. Eh? What do you say?
Oh, Davies, what a fool I am. Of course I'll do it. You really are very kind.
That's capital. Now, his name's Sir Henry Wotton. He's the Tory member for East something and lives in Queensgate here. That's his card.
Sir Henry Wotton was a cheerful, elderly buck whose manners were old-fashioned in their perfection. He received Donald in his rather impressive book-blind study, but the impressiveness wore off after a bit, for the books weren't those of a reader, but more like the reference section of a public library.
I'll tell you what it is, Cameron. I don't really want a secretary in the proper sense of the word. I'm not going to make speeches or any of that rubbish. Just going to stick to generalities. Truth is, I don't know much about this League of Fumble.
Nations, sir?
Something like that, yes. I can't think why the PM wants me to go. Well, he's all in favour of this League caper, so there we are, I'm going. That'll be my contribution. I'll expect you to find my hat, keep me posted with the cricket scores, and see I don't run out of essentials like whiskey. Think you can manage that?
It'll be a pleasure, sir.
Splendid. We leave on Friday morning, so you better run round to the FO and fix up the passports.
Right away, sir.
Oh, and Cameron.
Yes, sir.
See if you can find out, I don't know, something about this League thing.
Once in Geneva, Donald found it very hard to keep his mind on the task of studying the English representatives. There were so many distractions. The streets were crowded with strange sights. Abyssinians in great blue robes, wearing great black beards, Chinese, Japanese, Siamese, Cochinese, Tonkinese and Annamese, moving scrutably hither and thither while Frenchmen chattered and Australians strode in big hats. South Americans abounded, dark men with roving eyes and a passion for kissing typists in lifts. Maharajas, descended from 10,000 gods, walked as if conscious of their ancestry. Newsboys, usually well over 80 years old, sold papers written in every conceivable language, but mainly that of the United States. After a week of preliminaries, Donald had to make a stern resolution to eschew frivolities and get down to business.
And now, Cameron, it seems I've been assigned to the, what is it now?
Committee for the Abolition of Social Abuses, sir?
Yeah, that sounds about right. So be a good chap and run along to the Secretariat, see if you can find out what the deuce these abuses things are.
Yes, sir.
And then get the FO to tell us our official policy. I don't want to go round saying we're for it if we're again, or vice versa.
On entering the Foreign Office premises, Donald was instantly abashed at finding himself in the midst of a perfect vision of beauty and elegance. On all sides, radiant young ladies whacked away with dainty fingers at typewriting machines. The air was full of incense, and blood rushed to Donald's head. A golden-haired Aphrodite slid up to him. He wanted to fly, but his legs wouldn't move. He perspired vehemently along for the quiet midden at the means of Balspindi.
May I help you, sir?
I need to... That is, I'd like to...
Oh, sir, you've dropped your hat.
Oh, yes, excuse me. There we are. Now, I'd like to see someone about, abuses... No. You see, I work for Sir Henry Wotton, and I need to know our official policy on...
Oh, yes. You want Mr. Cartwright Pendragon?
Oh, good. Thank you so much.
Your hat again, sir.
Oh, sorry. I'll just... Oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to touch your leg. I mean...
That's all right, sir.
I was reaching for my hat. That's all. There was no...
I realise that, sir.
You're not offended?
Sir, you forget. We're used to dealing with the Venezuelans.
The inner sanctum was a strange contrast to the outer room. Three young men were sitting in complete silence at three gilt-edged marble-topped tables. None of them looked up as Donald came in.
Well?
Mr. Carteret Pendragon?
No, sir, my name is Cosholton Stanbury. Mr. Carteret Pendragon is the gentleman over there, to the left of Mr. Wildingham Uffington.
Ah.
Yes, can I help?
How do you do? I'm Donald Cameron, Sir Henry Wooden's private secretary.
I do sit down, Mr. Donald Cameron.
Thank you. It's just Cameron. I'm not double-barreled.
Oh? Anyway.
It's about the Social Abuses Commission. Sir Henry wants to know which line to take on synthetic beer.
I don't think I quite follow.
Well, he thinks he'll have to make a speech about it, and he wants to know what to say.
Oh, you know, the usual things. Devotion of British Commonwealth to ideals of League, nation of peace lovers, all must cooperate, wonderful work of League, praise of the Secretariat, economy and League expenditure, a word about Woodrow Wilson. Anything I've left out?
French.
Oh, yes. A tribute to the French.
Why a tribute to the French?
Well, it does no harm, and the French like it. So, good day.
Oh, wait, what about the synthetic beer?
What about it?
I mean, what is our policy?
Policy? My dear sir, we don't have policies about things.
But don't we... don't you... Doesn't Great Britain take an independent line about anything?
Independent line?
Whatever for. We're here to preserve balances. To maintain equilibriums.
Equilibria.
Yes. After all, there are proportions. One must have a sense of equipoise.
And what about brothels? What do we say about those?
Well, at the last six assemblies, we've simply said we don't know what they are. All you have to do is say it again. Broadly speaking, you're fairly safe to take it as a generalisation. And so far as organised vice is concerned, we, as an empire, might reasonably be described as more or less against it. Good day.
Dunnell went out with the feeling he gained some sort of insight into the English genius for diplomacy, though for the life of him he couldn't have explained how it worked. But of course, that was the genius of it. The president of the Committee for the Suppression of Social Abuses was the senior Caspian delegate. He was able to deal most authoritatively with the issue of drug trafficking, being himself a lifelong heroin addict. But when the drug section of the agenda had been dealt with, the president's efficiency fell off considerably, partly due to his lack of interest in the subjects, but mainly because between injections he was inclined to nod off. The vice chairman, a courtly Chinese, saved the situation by springing to his feet and saying in slow but perfect French,
"The hour is now 1:45, and we have labored long and earnestly this morning, and I would put it to you that the time is at hand to decide whether to adjourn now for refreshment or whether to continue without interval."
"The vice chairman says that if we don't stop now, we miss lunch."
"Oh, right,
When it fell to him to address the assembly, Sir Henry Wotton found no difficulty in keeping to the lines laid down for him by Mr. Carteret Pendragon. First came his peroration against the traffic in synthetic beer.
"And as you know, we British are a nation of peace lovers, and we must all cooperate in honour of the wonderful work that is being done by the League. For as that fine statesman, Mr. Woodrow Wilson, once said..."
Then he was required to speak on the matter of houses of ill repute.
"And in honour of the wonderful work that is being done by the League, we must all cooperate, for are we not a nation of peace lovers, we British? Just so are the French, to whom I must pay tribute. And I know that if Mr. Woodrow Wilson were alive today..."
His two speeches were so very alike that, due to a secretarial error, the one about synthetic beer was printed in the section of the official report relating to the houses of ill repute, and vice versa. No one noticed. But after the speeches had been delivered, there was nothing more for Donald to do.
"I'm grateful to you, my boy."
"Thank you, Sir Henry. It was nothing, really."
"Nonsense. If it hadn't been for all your groundwork, I don't think I could have aimed my speeches so precisely to the heart of the matter as I did.
Well,
and if my chap Peterson doesn't lick that scarlet fever soon, you'll be getting the job for good."
"Oh, no, I couldn't do that. No offence, sir. It's just that, well... I meant to be writing this book about England."
"England? England, eh? Well, you know what you need to do."
"Yes. No."
"You need to go and see my sister in Buckinghamshire. Hmm? No one could understand England till he's seen Bucks."
Sitting in his sleeper in the Paris Express, Donald ran over in his mind the result of the 4 weeks' entertainment at which he'd assisted. But he was utterly unable to detect how the subjects of his still unwritten book had gone about their inscrutable and mysterious paths, their wonders to perform. In his bafflement, he could only conclude, in the realms of international affairs, the English are the supreme artists. Next time, Donald somewhat recklessly enters the British political arena without a phrase book.
"First class, Bundabust. We'll put you up tomorrow at the ironworks at tiffin time. I've got the hang of our dope."
"Dope? I've got the leaflets here."
"Oh, don't worry about them. You don't need facts or any of that tommy rot. Just stick to our three planks. One, the Empire, first, last and always. Two, down with the Reds. Three, work for the unemployed."
Is there any stuff about how we're going to find work for the unemployed?"
"By backing up the Empire, of course. That and the abolition of the dole."
And he meets William Rhodes of the East Riding, an extremely well-travelled man.
"I went to Hungary once with a machine for weeding between rows of fruit trees. Stayed 2 years. Demerara's a queer place. Mm. Rum's cheaper than water in Demerara. Have you ever drunk rum?
Oh, during the war, I had quite a lot.
I can tell you a funny thing about Demerara rum.
Most of ours came from Jamaica.
I was in Demerara, ploughing drainage ways for getting water into canals, when I hit on a lovely notion. I made a special carburetor that would take rum instead of petrol. Join us then.
Part 4 of England, They're England by A.G. MacDonald was adapted by Bob Sinfield and narrated by Leslie Phillips, with Sam Graham as Donald Cameron, Christopher Benjamin as Sir Henry Wotton, Peter Kelly as Mr. Carter at Pendragon, Katie Odie as the Secretary, and Sean Prendergast as Davies. Other parts were played by members of the cast. Technical presentation was by Graham Harper. The director was Neil Cargill. England, They're England is a Splice of Life production for BBC Radio 2.